Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. My name's Alex, I'm your host today, and today we're having a chat with Ben Meadley. Now, Ben is a Mica Flight Paramedic for Ambulance Victoria, and he's currently doing his doctoral project where he's researching the physiological and metabolic health of paramedics. So we're going to have a chat today a bit about that, but we're also going to have a chat about the importance of getting into research to advance the paramedic profession. So Ben, thanks for joining today. Would you like to introduce yourself a little bit?
Yeah, thanks, Alex. I'm a Mica flight paramedic, as you said, or intensive care flight paramedic, as it's generically known. I've been a paramedic for nearly 23 years and currently undertaking a PhD at Monash University, looking at paramedic health and wellbeing. And I do quite a bit of teaching at Monash University. I'm currently half-time at Monash for 2021. Teaching into the undergraduate and postgraduate programs and sharing that with my clinical work at the helicopter base.
Very interesting. So what made you want to get into research, and particularly the fact that you're not necessarily looking at the patient side for research, you're looking at the paramedic specifically?
Yeah, it's interesting. Along the way, I never really sought out to be a researcher. I had a background in exercise physiology before I was a paramedic. And when I did that undergraduate degree, it's very research focused. Certainly the outcomes of research drive a lot of the practice in sports science and exercise physiology. So I got an interest in that area during my undergraduate degree, which was not really related to paramedicine, obviously, but there's a lot of crossover in regards to human physiology and anatomy and pathophysiology. So there's that kind of interest there. Then I went about my clinical career effectively for the next 10 to 15 years, and I picked up a few interests on new techniques or medications or whatever it might have been along the way, and just kind of delved into a little bit. So I never sought to be a researcher. It kind of just evolved and happened, because as you would all appreciate and your listeners would appreciate, you end up with far more questions than you do answers in this profession. So you find yourself asking a lot of questions, and sometimes you need some pretty robust and evidence-based research to drive whatever the change might be or to gain a further understanding of a certain area. And then to explore that a bit more, there's a lot of things in paramedicine that we do that we inherit from the wider health service, whether that be in primary care, critical care, wherever it might be. And there's a lot of people doing really good research in those areas. For me personally, with a range of different commitments, including family, work. I live in regional Victoria, which limits some things that I can do, but for a larger benefit. And that kind of meant that the time I was going to spend on completing a PhD had to be something I was really driven to do. So to bring that full circle back to my undergraduate training and then encompass the profession, I kind of lent towards that interest in paramedic health and wellbeing with a focus on the things that I've got an interest in personally, which is physical activity and general overall good health, nutrition, sleep, and the links then are the effects that the profession has on individuals and what general health means to paramedics and how we can promote that and promote career longevity, minimise industry and keep people happy and healthy and able to deliver good patient care.
That sounds very interesting. And there isn't a lot of information or studies out there specifically tailored towards paramedic wellbeing. So do you find that hard, or are you, not having previous information to draw on or do anything, so having to do that all yourself and, I guess, start that research around what you're looking at, because there wouldn't be anything?
Yeah, you're right. So generally speaking, the tradition is in a PhD, you start with a systematic literature review, and that's the basis to drive the further projects. And that became quite complicated in this space because, well, one, my project's fairly diverse, but secondarily, there's limited information. And people do publish literature reviews and systematic reviews on limited information quite frequently, but it just didn't really fit. So what you're suggesting is actually right on the money. There's a big gap. And I had initially thought, well, you know, we can cover a lot of that. As it turns out, and as anyone else who's been involved in research could attest to, you do have to stop somewhere within the bounds of a project, because it's complicated to do good, robust research. So I'll answer a few questions, but not as many as I thought at the start, that's for sure. But there is a lot of work to do. There's a lot of strategies, a lot of confounders as well to the research. So age, background, personality type, accessibility to you know, good health in general, the shifts that people work, there's a whole range of things that can change the outlook for people. So I've just finished this afternoon, actually, a paper in it, looking at the flight paramedic group that I work with and their cardiovascular and physical activity levels, or cardiovascular health and physical activity. It's a very small niche group, but it might have some answers for which we can use some strategies to improve paramedic health overall, for example. So, yeah, lots of work to do.
That sounds intense. So what have you found has been the biggest barriers or the biggest impact of shift work and the role of a paramedic, so like the paramedic profession, on their well-being?
So there's a couple of themes that emerge from some of the work that I've done, and that's primarily around the sudden change in your sleep patterns and the circadian disruption that occurs if you've not been a shift worker previously. And one of the big studies we've done is in graduate paramedics in their first year of practice. We look at them on day one when they started with Ambulance Victoria, and then came back and looked at them again in 12 months on a range of measures such as cardiometabolic biomarkers, their physical activity levels. We monitored their physical activity with a Fitbit for a year, literally every minute for 365 days. And a pretty good sample size, so 60 or so, and we've been able to look at the changes that occurred in the first year. And the themes that emerge are certainly a change in sleep habits, a change in variable physical activity that changes, obviously, with shift type and the varying fatigue levels that occur. And we did some nutritional analysis as well. And all of these things have probably just shown that first year is a bit of a shock to the system. There wasn't a whole lot of change, but there were some concerns in regards to how people actually started the profession. So there was some concerning behaviours with regards to nutrition, physical activity, some of the body composition that people came to the job with were mildly concerning, because if there is a trend to have increased cardiovascular disease, risk, decreased physical activity levels, poor sleep patterns, then anything you start with potentially puts you on the back foot, I guess, from the get-go. So we'll follow those people up long-term, but within the scope of my PhD project, we're only able to really look at that first year, otherwise I'll never finish. So we've already got a plan going to follow these people up long-term to see where those changes actually occur, because we don't know when these postulated risks to cardiovascular health and the associated elements of good health get affected, whether that's early, late, or in the middle of the career.
Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. And I was having a chat to a graduate paramedic the other day who we were talking about sleep and how that was one of the major things that they struggled with. And I think it was about 6 months into their graduate position, they decided to really research sleep and how best to, I guess, mitigate the effects of shift work on their circadian rhythm and hopefully have a better routine towards sleep. Have you found that there is a best way to, I guess, optimize sleep for shift work, or is that something that you're planning on looking at in the future? And or, I guess, teaching that to students and to graduates at the start of their profession, I guess?
Yeah, so the first part to your question, I've got a collaborator who's a postdoctoral researcher at Monash who's actually doing the bulk of the sleep work. His outcomes are still being processed, but effectively it'll be looking at changes in sleep habit in that first year. So we'll wait and see what happens. the end result is exactly what you said to finish off your question, which was that do we intend on providing education to people how to mitigate all of these changes they're about to face? Absolutely. That's one of the key drivers. And we have commenced, we've brought together a whole bunch of collaborative research people from various departments at the university into the Paramedic Health and Wellbeing Unit, or the 4U as we call it. And that department is looking at doing exactly what you say, taking the findings we have, bringing the disciplines from around the university together. So, you know, physiology, nutrition, physiotherapy, education, epidemiology, and then taking the information and making sure it translates to useful information for junior paramedics in particular, and not just junior paramedics, all paramedics. But I think, even though it's 23 years ago, I remember the shock to the system for me starting shift work. And I'm not really the type of person, especially at this point in my career, who would, and I'm between night shifts as we speak, I'm not the type of person who would say, suck it up and deal with it. It's absolutely not the case. You need to develop strategies to keep yourself well. Because as time goes on, I guess speaking to a range of different senior paramedics, and certainly my experience is it gets worse, not better. You don't necessarily get better at it, because as your life changes, if you have children or you have a partner or somebody else's children or whatever it might be, all of these factors in your life that change over time need adjusting of your schedule. And when I was saying this to my wife the other day, actually, you know, before my first night shift and having largely worked a 2 10-hour day and 2 14-hour night roster for almost all of those 23 years and still doing that to this day, before my first night shift, I'd do a bit of exercise in the morning and then I'd just sit on the couch and just prepare for the assault of a 14-hour night shift. And then you just go into survival mode for 2 days, basically. But, you know, today, sometime later, that day is not sitting in front of the couch. It's getting the kids to school. It's, you know, getting the washing done, getting the lawn mowed, whatever it might be, then doing some exercise and then realizing suddenly it's 3:30 and I've got to go to work. And then hoping that it's not too busy because I'm, you know, tired before I've even walked in the front door. So you have to be a bit cautious about that as time goes on. But it's an evolving strategy that you'll have to manage throughout your career. And we would like, as a result of the research, to inform people on how to manage that best, because there's also no one size fits all. People have different innate circadian rhythms themselves. Some people are night people. Some people are morning people. And you kind of develop all of these strategies over time and what works best for you.
That's really interesting. So have you already found some really good strategies that mitigate the effects yet that you can talk about, or not just yet?
We don't have anything that is research-based per se. Again, it's largely an anecdote. And I think people go into a process of finding it out for themselves. There's really kind of core advice, if you like, that is: one, that sleep is good; two, you need to protect your sleep; and three, there are some research-based concerns that people probably aren't sleeping the way they used to, in the sense that there's distractions to sleep more than there ever have been. It's well known and well researched that, you know, smart devices, for example, in the bedroom are probably a threat to good sleep for a lot of people. And I personally grew up largely without those devices, and they're only an advent of the last 15 years or so for me. And I've been very conscious to make sure that's not part of it. But we also understand that that's not necessarily the reality. If you've only grown up with those devices around you, well, then that's the normal. And it can be really, really challenging. Now, in saying all of that, the point you made earlier was really valid, in that you spoke to a graduate paramedic who's gone away and done some research and actually actively and proactively tried to sort out their own sleep habits to try and manage it, because it is quite confronting, especially in those first couple of years. And if I expand that out to the rest of the stuff we've looked at, even though I said some people come to the profession probably a little bit in a concerning state, again, my experience anecdotally, and certainly within some of the participants within our studies, is actually really quite far the other way. The generation of junior paramedics coming through now are more well-informed and more able to access information than any generation previous to them, and will seek information without necessarily having to be prompted. And there's a real problem-solving attitude towards managing your own health, largely, because I think people are more aware. It's more of a, it's more in your face in the kind of Insta world, if you like, that you can't go too far without seeing some kind of wellness-based information, whether it's accurate or not. That's a whole nother conversation. But it is a concept that's at the forefront of people's minds and the media as landscape, I guess, as we know it today, than it's ever has been. So every write-up room in a hospital and every ambulance bay or ambulance had a bucket of M&Ms and some pretty bad food in it when I started out. But you're more likely to see a punnet of strawberries or blueberries in an ambulance or a write-up room today than that would have been unheard of. And I know it sounds very anecdotal, but it's a pretty noticeable thing that there is a better awareness of just general population health, which of course then transfers to the student and graduate paramedic population as well.
Absolutely. And just touching on then, when you talked about a bit about nutrition, how have you found in your study about like nutrition and physical activity has been impacted by the paramedic profession?
I think there's some risk in a number of areas, especially in those first couple of years. So the things that have been identified in the wider literature is that the inconsistent eating, there is the danger of being influenced by your shift partner, for example, quite heavily. That's kind of a well-reported phenomenon. You might end up at a fast food restaurant you had no intention of going to, but because you're there anyway, then you just succumb to the pressure and that's your meal for the night. Sometimes you just got to take what you can get, and every paramedic and student paramedic would understand that that's the reality of the job. You're a mobile workforce and sometimes you have to take what you can get, and you can plan, the best meal that you may never see. And, that's my reality to this day, really. You have all the good intentions. I've taken my dinner to work for probably the vast majority of that time. And there's been a lot of lasagnas and pastas, end up in a bin somewhere because they're 3 days old and never got eaten or whatever it is. But, make a really good attempt to try and eat well, bring a bag of fruit as the snacks, and it's, that's the intention. There's some interesting work coming out of the nutrition lab at Monash, who supervise a lot of our projects, and they're looking at changes in glucose and insulin levels in paramedics and other shift workers, looking at the influence of meal timing, for example, so not eating overnight, so you don't eat in opposition to your circadian rhythm. There's some real promise in that area, which is this concept of chrononutrition or chronobiology, linking together to identify when you should eat and when you shouldn't eat. And there's a range of other strategies that are being examined. We're just about to start a study where we're going to, and most paramedics and paramedic students would understand the concept of continuous glucose monitoring, which many diabetic patients would use, for their own diagnostic purposes. We're actually going to use continuous glucose monitors to assess the changes in on-shift and off-shift glucose levels in paramedics. And that study will start actually in the next couple of weeks, which will be super interesting, because I think a lot of people working in paramedicine will talk to you about the crashes and the sugar headaches from the half a bag of snakes or whatever it is. So it's going to be really interesting to align dietary patterns with changes in glucose level. These things point to significant risk of cardiovascular disease, the onset of type 2 diabetes. So there's a lot of really promising work, which hopefully then drives advice. I'll get to the physical activity in a sec, but the hardest thing to do in the world is change human behaviour. And when you introduce complex work environments that are stressful in a range of ways, that, as we all know, can affect any good intentions quite significantly. So changing human behaviour to improve health, we know, is a huge battle for all public health services, as it is. But then you introduce the complexity of paramedicine to that really challenges things. With physical activity, the things that we actually, there was a paper released about 48 hours ago that was done on 15 Ambulance Victoria paramedics by a bunch of collaborators from a couple of different universities, looking at steps per day amongst other things. I can send you the link, so it's an open access article, so people can have a look at it. And it looks at the amount of steps per day that the paramedics have done. And we did the same study, which they haven't got to publish in it yet, that looked, among other things, at steps per day. And it was interesting that the numbers effectively were identical in their cohort as to ours, which were two separate groups. But that was two groups of Ambulance Victoria paramedics working on the road. Then, again, having just finished typing the study today, the flight paramedic group, interestingly, had nearly double the amount of steps per day, irrespective of the type of shift worked, than the general or wider ambulance population. So there's a range, and that goes hand in hand with a occupation or a part of the occupation that's physically demanding, and there's a range of other things that we would hypothesize lead to that type of personality that is attracted to the role, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a whole bunch of data that's coming out. We know that the things we want to see improvements are in probably steps per day as a lesser of the two, but the most important thing is this idea of moderate to vigorous physical activity and the amount of minutes per week people can undertake that type of activity. And again, looking at our two studies, the graduate paramedics in their first year were just meeting recommended levels, and the flight paramedic group had tripled the graduate level of moderate to vigorous physical activity. We're unable to split that between occupational activity and off time activity in personal time. It require an immense amount of work to do that. It's just kind of grossed up average values at the moment, but it's quite significant. And so we need to look a bit further about what behavioural characteristics of different populations or cohorts, what those characteristics are, and whether we can use some lessons learned to improve physical activity, nutrition, sleep, etc., for all paramedics, because you don't want the job to cost you your health.
That makes a lot of sense. That's actually a really good point. And, you know, we talked about all the physical sort of elements of well-being. Are you looking also at, like you said before, the stress and, you know, the mental well-being as well of paramedics, and that impact of the job, I guess? Does it have a link to your cardiovascular disorders that you're talking about?
So we aren't looking at that. And part of the reason we're not is because of the fact that that's pretty well researched and it's well acknowledged. So Alex Walco, who's the postdoctoral research fellow at the Turner Brain Institute, he's helping out in this graduate cohort, he's leading a project in the sleep area, but he's also looking at stress hormone cortisol response. So he's looking at that, and we'll publish together on those outcomes quite shortly. And so, but that's, it's not looking at the infield response per se, it's just a general response to work. But it will be interesting, we don't have that data yet, but it'll be interesting to see what happens and whether that changes over that first year of practice. But largely, it's an interesting space to look at, because as time moves on, and we know that paramedics are at risk of certain increases in poor mental health, what we did see in both Alex's work, in some of his samples, or the instruments he used to look at paramedic mental health, we used a very fairly basic one. And what we did see in the graduate group was that there was a significant dip in their self-reported mental health. And this is both of our instruments that we used in the same cohort indicated a significant dip at the halfway mark of the first year, and that they didn't recover to baseline values by the 12-month mark. And again, we need to explore why that is, but I suspect it's largely due to being at probably the peak of the graduate or intern year, where they're probably under, that you've got just enough knowledge to kind of know what you're doing, but you've still got 6 months ahead of you with assessments and trying to get your head around good patient care and all of the other things, like the health-related elements that we spoke about. So that was quite interesting. And I met Alex in the hallway and he had mentioned it. And I said, well, I've just kind of looked at my numbers and we found the same thing. So that was interesting. And we'll see how that goes. There might be some qualitative work we can do to actually ask that group as to why that was the case. And again, that's an area for improvement for ambulance services probably. But then on top of that, where the interesting area to look at, I think, going forward is that the information now is starting to indicate that organisational dysfunction is just as likely to cause significant mental health problems as is seen major trauma and critical illness over an extended period of time. So yeah, sure, those things are well acknowledged to increase rates of PTSD, etc. However, there is some concerns around organisational dysfunction that can lead to that. And I'm not making suggestions that ambulance services are necessarily that way. All organisations in the private and public sector have some degree of that. No one's perfect. So it's interesting to see how that might evolve and how we might look at that.
That's interesting. So with your look at the physiological and metabolic factors that are associated with the paramedic well-being, you got into all of this research, and what drove you to do research was, like you said before, there was nothing that, you know, you didn't think you were going to become a researcher necessarily. But what is the importance of research? And now that we're a registered profession, how important is that to sort of grow the profession for the future?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And one of the, I guess the first part is for me personally, again, it was just that drive of having finding a question and not answering it. So the other half of my PhD is looking at physical employment standards. So the type of physical test you might need to do to become a paramedic. My focus is on the specialist teams that respond in ambulance services more so than it is the entry-level physical assessments that you might do. And in that space, I guess, there's a lot of arbitrariness to standards that are set because some person thought that was a good idea. And so I wanted to, it's interesting, there's a strong science behind that process of developing physical employment standards. So you have to go into research to do the research to prove the point. You know, Ben Meadley's idea about what the standard is just not good enough. It needs to be validated. It needs to be reliable. It needs to, for example, the tasks you might get asked to do in a physical employment test has to have some bearing on the actual tasks you're required to do in your role. And it's important not to discriminate against those who are capable of doing the job. But unfortunately, or if you want to look at it that way, it's actually important to eliminate people who aren't suitable to do the job. And that's in a range of areas, but that my focus has been the physical employment standards work. So that area in particular drove my desire to do some research to validate some of those processes and evolve them to make sure that the workforce is able to perform the role that they're chartered to do, but additionally to make sure that it's fair for people. And so that if you did fail it, for example, then you would have the ability to say, okay, well, I've been unsuccessful. And that's particularly pertinent in the specialist areas because the failure rate of a complex selection process is higher than it would be in other areas. And so you need to be able to stand with your hand on your heart and show the evidence base as to why that's developed. It also drives the ability to provide people with a whole lot of information on how they can meet the standard. And again, that flows across a whole range of areas of paramedicine, not just in regards to physical employment standards. So yeah, all of that has driven, I guess, my ability to use that to the advantage of the profession. That's what I hope. And I've forgotten the second half of your question, but if you could refresh me, I'll answer it for you.
So for our students that mainly are listening, we have mainly students and graduates, what is the importance of getting into research in order to sort of grow the profession now that we're registered?
Yeah, sure. That is very important. And currently, as I mentioned earlier, I'm kind of in this quasi-academic clinical role where I do a couple of days a week at the university and a couple of days a week on the helicopter, which is, it's a pretty good deal, certainly for me. But I think it's bigger than me. The idea is I think that this is an important thing for the profession. And the person who's working the other half of this is driving it as well. He's also an intensive care paramedic who's doing half-time Monash, half-time at his regular ambulance station and working as an intensive care paramedic. So I think what we need to do is align ourselves with how other health services evolve. And the idea of the academic clinician, for example, is very normal in medicine, nursing, other health professions, allied health professions, physiotherapy, occupational therapy, whatever it might be. So that provides the link between the academic and the clinical or the practical. And it also, that constant relationship and that interaction between the research and academic part of our profession and the operational and clinical part means you can answer those questions as you go. You can have the drive for important projects. People often will say, well, we need the X procedure. That's really important for paramedicine. And so we'll go and prove it, because when we're not practicing patient-centered care, unless the thing that we're trying to provide the patient has any utility in improving their outcome. And there's a lot of controversies in that area. And one big notable one is paramedic-led RSI, which is always something that's spoken about, but is also incredibly complex from a research and an evidence point of view. There's, for example, a historical study that was done in Ambulance Victoria that said it might improve outcomes. But, you know, that's getting old now, and it's time to re-look at what the evidence says today with contemporary practitioners and a changing overall health system. So it's important that we're honest as a profession with ourselves. We don't become too academicalized, if that's a word, in the sense that, you know, that's all we're thinking about. We have to balance it out with the collective experience of the profession, but together that experience and the evidence base is what drives the profession forward. And it helps you go forward, us go forward as a profession, to represent ourselves well in the wider health space. And there's a lot behind that, and we're moving into that era of paramedicine fairly quickly, which is great.
That makes a lot of sense. And that's a really good point, in the sense that, you know, we need to be able to prove the things that we want to be able to do or shouldn't be doing. Have you found that all the research that you've done from now and in the past, has it helped you in your role as a MICA flight paramedic now?
Yeah, definitely. And I had a conversation with a student, shall we say, who in one of the courses I teach, about a complaint that there was too many questions in an exam based on epidemiological information, for example. Which I can see how people might think that asking someone, you know, the rate of incidence of a disease process or whatever it might be irrelevant to putting a cannula in. And it can be very easy to get technically focused and not think that academic information is useful. But in fact, the research, or reading the research, or doing the research, and certainly I've got a background in a range of clinical projects that I researched before I undertook my PhD, and a lot of that stuff, you know, drives my practice to this day. Ultrasound might be an example. There's bits of pre-hospital ultrasound that are useful, and there's bits that probably aren't, and that's linked to the research. And so, you know, I focus on where the evidence base is, which is likely to benefit the patient. So absolutely. And then, you know, you can use that research not only to drive your practice, but to change policy as time goes on. And you won't be able to change things, and all paramedics and students will look at clinical guidelines over their careers and go, I don't agree with that. And that's fine. It's absolutely imperative that people don't agree with it, because that's how you drive the change. But you'll only drive the change through research. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to go out and do the legwork yourself. But it might be that you collaborate with someone and start to learn about how you can drive change. And that is heavily reliant on really well-performed kind of systematically undertaken research that is strong, strongly then supports your practice or refutes it, whichever it is. So it's important to be fairly agnostic and non-biased in all of those ways. And a lot of people have firm ideas about what's the right thing and the other right thing to do or not, but that may be contrary to or supported by the evidence. So it just has to be there to drive change.
That makes a lot of sense. So even with that, with all the research you're doing now about the physical health of paramedics, has that all your research that you've done and prior to, I guess, finishing it, has that changed the way that you've approached shift work and the way you've approached the job?
I think there's some confronting things in there. Like you look at some of the dietary analysis, for example, and I see some poor dietary patterns in both the groups we researched, and you know, I probably see a bit of myself in some of those areas. And so you're a bit more conscious of some of those things when it's actually written down. It's hard from an individual point of view. I'm a bad example in this, in that sense, I guess, because I personally think I manage it well. Now, whether I do or not is another story, but I've got some pretty robust strategies around exercise. I'm very well supported in my family by having excellent nutrition as part of my day-to-day life. If I was not there with my family, that might be a little bit different, because sometimes, especially when you're fatigued, you take the path of least resistance. But I'm lucky to have that support. And so I've been able to get into some good habits over the years. The thing that probably still suffers the most is sleep, and sometimes that's hard. And again, any experienced paramedic will tell you that the sleep, for example, between night shifts gets harder and harder to protect and harder to kind of salvage if it's interrupted. So that's probably an area I need personal focus in, and probably all of us for that matter. But I think I'm probably in a reasonably good space. Now, in saying that, after 23 years of a 10-14 roster, I'm looking forward to a point in my near future that doesn't involve working night shifts for a full year continuously. So it's probably not good for you to see out your career working multiple night shifts a week.
Certainly, that makes a lot of sense. You've, you know, done all this research. You've got a massive, I guess, history in doing all this research. How can students get involved in it, and you know, would you encourage them to start out whilst they're in their degree to do some?
It's a good question. I think there's a lot of different ways people could go about it. So when I finished my undergraduate degree, and at the time it was still a vocational training program to become a paramedic, so I had an undergraduate degree. I decided I didn't want to be an exercise physiologist, I wanted to be a paramedic. And so irrespective if somebody told me to do some research or not, or whatever it might be, I just wanted to be a paramedic yesterday. So that I understand the kind of mentality that people may think, well, you know, I just want to be a paramedic. Let's just get to the point. Now, on the other side of the coin, I think that, you know, you can keep striving for that goal, no doubt, but you can do both. I think it's not for everyone. Some people are not going to be won't lean towards that analytical type of mind in the same way as everyone else. But I do think having an awareness and being able to pick up a paper, for example, and critically appraise a paper, you don't need to be a statistician to understand it, but to know what an odds ratio is or a confidence interval, you don't need to know the statistical background to it, but just to know what it means. At the minimum, I think you should be able to critically appraise a paper that says, you know, says something that's been published, and it says, you know, needle decompression is really good and never has any problems. Well, then you should be able to critically appraise that paper to say, well, this is not particularly well researched. Or contrary, you find a study that says whatever the outcome is, and you go, well, that's a really well done study. So, you know, you kind of got to look at that and take what it says. Now, if you want to take the next step, then honours programs are the good place to start. One thing, if you want to kind of lean towards how my career evolved, by the time, I'm not the youngest person by any stretch of the imagination, but by 32, I had been an ALS paramedic, a MICA paramedic, a MICA paramedic clinical instructor, worked on the single responder unit, and I was on the helicopter. And then shortly thereafter had, you know, clinical instructor experience on the helicopter, et cetera, et cetera. So kind of by my mid-30s, that is pretty much the clinical endpoint in Ambulance Victoria, from that kind of critical care space, not around the rest of the service. And then I'm like, okay, well, what do I do now? So I guess one piece of advice would be, if you're considering doing something like honours and you're thinking, well, I'm going to miss out on being a paramedic, you know, I've got to do that now, then maybe you use that time in the immediate post-undergraduate phase to consider something like an honours program. There's always opportunities down the track to do master's programs that might involve research, and then PhD, of course. But, you know, I didn't start my PhD until I was 41, and I'm not particularly concerned about that in any way. And I probably rushed my clinical career early and then have found myself, you know, wanting. And, you know, 44 now, and I've been on the helicopter for 12 years. So that sounds old to a lot of the listeners, no doubt, but I've still got, you know, 20 years of my career to go. So that's just something to think about, that if you're at the bottom end of your career and you're going, well, I've got to get out there and get clinical exposure and experience, something like an honours program is a really worthy consideration, because it'll tell you whether you're interested in research or not. By the time you get to the end of that year, you'll have a pretty good idea. And there's a lot of really, really good people who mentor people in paramedicine honours programs around the country, and they're a great opportunity to explore research if that's something you want to do, and it gives you another string to your bow to move forward in the profession. And I think the opportunities for things like academic clinicians, for example, they don't have to be intensive care level or extended care level paramedics. There's no reason an ACP or ALS level paramedic can't be an academic clinician. It doesn't require a critical care skill set. And I would really hope that, you know, the things that we're doing now is starting to drive that idea of people working for ambulance services and universities concurrently in a range of clinical roles that allow for that interface. Because the real world of ambulance is not flying around in a helicopter, I can assure you. The real world of ambulance is out providing primary health care and solving the problems of the wider community, rather than, you know, picking and choosing major trauma jobs or whatever it is.
That's a really good way to put it. And hopefully our listeners who have considered doing research or anything like that do consider doing honours programs or get into it. So I'm mindful of your time, and I do appreciate you coming on today. So I'll go through our last three questions. They're the three questions that everyone gets asked on this podcast to give students the opportunity to hear the different answers to the same one. So the first one is, what has been your biggest mistake that's resulted in your greatest learning?
Oh, yeah, well, that's an interesting one. I think, you know, I don't think you could isolate one thing, but I think if you want to talk about it as a concept, it would be falling away from the system that you know works, and that largely focuses around assessment of a patient. So I don't occasionally, catch myself out from falling away from that system, and that's where errors occur. So I was lucky to have a lot of good mentors and teachers, especially as I trained as an intensive care paramedic, who got me to follow a system every time. And to this day, I still use that system, and it's not complex. The system is, you know, just a standard patient assessment. And then it's the permutations and combinations of the critical care concepts that go off the site. I think that the cognitive load that is your burden in this job is high enough as it is, that you don't need to complicate it anymore. In fact, I spent a great deal of my time simplifying the core requirements of what's needed to be done. And if I find myself not doing that, overcomplicating things and falling outside of a systematic process, then I think that that's where errors might occur. So I would always read out the label of a drug, for example, before I give it. If I don't do that, well, then I can identify historically that's where I've made a medication error. When I haven't followed the process that I know works every time, or if I haven't listened to a chest because I got a little bit, you know, rapid in my patient assessment, and I've missed a pneumothorax or I've missed a pulmonary edema or whatever it might be, you look back and you go, well, you didn't follow the system, and you make an error. So that would be, it's not a one specific example, but stick to your systems and it'll solve your problems.
Awesome. That seems to be a bit of a running theme. That's what Darren Hodge told us as well. And our second one is, what is one piece of advice that you would give to a student?
I would give the advice of linking back to what we just said, and that's just consider your career and don't be in too big a rush to get everything done. I personally think that this is a job you can do for a long career. And there's a lot of kind of media around, you know, not sticking out careers and working a number of careers. That's also fine. However, I think this is a job because it is a very, very good job, very rewarding, satisfying job that you can stick it out for a career. But the things that will burn you out and may compromise that are trying to rush your way through everything and do everything yesterday. Ironically, if I went back to myself in a time machine and told myself that advice, I don't think it would have changed the way I did things. But anyway, that's the advice I'll give nonetheless.
Oh, that's so true. And that's interesting what you said about the whole, you could be in the job for a long period of time, because we talked to Todd Weir, who's the director of Priority One, and he mentioned that they actually find that a lot of people, once they become a graduate, they actually stick in the job for quite some time.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a great job, but you've just got to, you do have to be realistic and just kind of think about your progress pretty early. Don't, and you know, the answer isn't helicopter every time, because it may not be for everyone, and it's difficult to get there for everyone. So
fair enough. So, and then our last one is, this one always stumps me because it's a tongue twister, but it's, what did you used to believe to be true that you no longer believe to be true?
Yeah, that's a pretty easy one. And it speaks to the student paramedic population. We're not an emergency service. We're an extension of the health service, whether that be primary health care or critical care. We just tailor the service to the patient. So I think that the generation of paramedics who are currently students and in their early career actually have the best appreciation for that than anyone, because I think the universities now are starting to really be honest with people rather than sell the lights and sirens. They're honest with their students about what the expectations are. Doesn't always result that way, but I really do think that that message that it's a very diverse career, and that any of that critical care work, doesn't matter where you are, can be reflected by walking into any emergency department in Australia or New Zealand or wherever, and there's only two or three resus bays, but there's 40 general cubicles. That's the health system right in front of you as a proportion of the work that you're going to see for your entire career, because not everyone's critically unwell. In fact, very, very few people are, and that the job that we do, and that includes me, I go to far more broken ankles than I do, you know, severe multi-trauma patients. So, you know, the reality is the job we do is providing primary healthcare, analgesia and patient support and reassurance. And then occasionally, you know, you shine. And so, you know, I'll finish that one with an anecdote from a very wise and respected colleague who calls, especially the pointy end paramedics, racehorses. You know, they get all the nice things. They get a nice stable. They get fed well. They get washed. Once a week, they trot them out. They go flash around for a couple of minutes and do all their exciting things, and they get put back in their stable. So that's a small percentage of ambulance. It's not the reality of ambulance.
That's great. Thank you so much for taking the time to have a chat to all of our listeners. You've provided some great insight into your research, also for students on how to get into research and why they should. And yeah, I love those little bits of pieces of wisdom at the end. That was awesome. Thank you so much. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. You can connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or you can email us at studentparamedicpodcast@gmail.com.